Welcome to the Saturday Frights Podcast. I am the Projectionist, your co-host for this radio program. Now, come join your host, Vic Sage, as we enter the vault to once again discuss retro horror films and television programs. There is a fifth dimension beyond that which is known to man. It is a dimension as vast as space and as timeless as infinity. It is in the middle ground between light and shadow, between science and superstition, and it lies between the pit of man's fears and the summit of his knowledge. This is the dimension of imagination. It is an area which we call the Twilight Zone.
All right, Projectionist. The vault cafeteria was out of Rockwood silver cups, but I did get you some Reese's peanut butter cups instead. They did have Byerly's orange drink, though, and I have to say it looks pretty tasty. Is the recording light on? Were you starting the show without me?
No need to thank me, Victor. I just so happened to notice that the Retroist started our Saturday Frights radio broadcast early, and was making sure that the dear listeners had something to listen to other than dead air.
You do know the podcast doesn't go out live, right? We could have edited out the dead air.
Nonsense! How else do the listeners at home tune into our radio show, eh?
Well, it sounds to me like you were already letting everyone know we're going to be talking about an episode of 1985's The Twilight Zone, The Shadow Man. One that it appeared you enjoyed when we screened it for the vault staff last week.
I will admit, Sage, I was rather fond of this particular television offering. Something about the character of the Shadow Man itself reminded me of something, although I can't quite place a finger on it.
Sure, a dark figure clad in a cloak and hat who sticks to the shadows and can only speak in a painful and forced whisper. No idea what might have made you enjoy that character at all.
Perhaps it is how he dealt with troublesome young people that I most admired.
Moving right along, friends. Thank you for joining us for a new Saturday Frights podcast. We are tackling a request
by Tony Cassatt of Bellevue, Nebraska.
I was about to say that, Projectionist. Tony has been a longtime listener to the podcast, stuck with us even through the hiatus, and has requested The Shadow Man numerous times. So this one's for you, Tony. Thanks for supporting the podcast. Now, I have mentioned this before on Doug McCoy's 80s Anthologies Episode by Episode podcast. I never missed an episode of CBS's attempt to reboot Rod Serling's classic Twilight Zone. I literally grew up on the show without knowing it, thanks to my father, who, at a loss for telling me bedtime stories as a kid, resorted to telling me the plots of Twilight Zone and Outer Limits shows. Yet again, not that I knew that at the time. When the original Twilight Zone began being shown in syndication, I was pretty gobsmacked that I knew the outcomes of nearly all of them, since I remembered the stories my father had told me. Being able to see the original episodes in syndication, I was so very pumped when I caught the first teaser for CBS's reboot in 1985.
For 20 years, the portal has been closed. It is about to be reopened. This is a detour, a twist in time, a curve of space. Journey into man's imagination with America's most fantastic storytellers. Coming soon to CBS, all new tales from the Twilight Zone.
A rather ominous tone to that television commercial, Sage.
Yeah, a little. I wasn't the only one who was excited about this reboot either. People in school were talking about it too, including our teacher in civics class. We actually ended up talking about the first episode after it aired, with the first two stories, Shatterday starring Bruce Willis, as well as A Little Peace and Quiet, which was at least inspired by the 1963 original Twilight Zone episode entitled A Kind of Stopwatch.
Is there a point to this tale?
To cut to the chase for the sake of my co-host's temperament, it was big news when The Twilight Zone returned to television. Being such a fan of the original series, when the first episode aired of the 1985 series, I noticed something, even back then, that the show was a little different with this reboot. It was darker and more than a little mean.
How so?
Well, as I've mentioned before on the show, more often than not with the original Twilight Zone, there was a sense of cosmic justice. Not always, of course. Generally, a character was given the opportunity to see they were on the wrong path, and then offered a chance to alter their fate. Or, if a character was evil, say like in the excellent Death's Head Revisited, they would be punished. That wasn't always the case with the 1985 Twilight Zone reboot. I can recall a few episodes where people who were innocent had a horrible fate befall them. Chilling, and certainly scary at times, but it didn't seem to be embracing the spirit of the original show.
Different times, Victor. The audiences of the day that visited the haunted drive-in to see 1951's The Thing from Another World would be appalled at the gore and nudity within 1985's Reanimator. With many patrons that I cater to now being bored by the masterpiece director Howard Hawks delivered in 1951.
I guess I can't disagree with your statement, my friend, but I would add that if you're attempting to reboot something, while I wouldn't expect it to be exactly like the previous show or film, it should embrace that same feeling. Otherwise, you might as well go off and create your own things, like the TV show's Tales from the Dark Side or Monsters did.
Perhaps you have a point.
Friends, I hope it doesn't sound like I'm trashing the 1985 Twilight Zone reboot. Our first episode of this show was from that series. It's just that I felt it was too different. By 1985, director Joe Dante had already had the hit horror comedy Gremlins, just a year earlier actually, as well as 1978's Piranha and 1981's The Howling. And of course, 1983's segment, It's a Good Life, from Twilight Zone the movie, which we covered on this show in the past.
Indeed. One of the least listened to broadcasts, if I remember correctly.
Yeah. Although, you have a point. That probably is one of our least popular shows. Gremlins was where I started to notice Joe Dante's name, thanks to watching it a million times when it hit VHS. That is truly when I started making the connection with Dante's past work, and looked forward to seeing that he was directing a new film, or television episode. Like in 85 with Explorers, or Amazing Stories. Besides Spielberg and Lucas, who were definitely the first directors I took notice of, for obvious reasons, I think it's safe to say that Joe Dante was, and still is, one of my favorite directors of all time.
He got his start in the industry as a movie critic, I do believe.
You're right. After Dante graduated from the Philadelphia College of Art, he did work as a critic. But in 1974, he began working for Roger Corman as a trailer editor, an apprenticeship at first, as I've read it. Although, I should point out that Dante originally intended to have a career not as a film director, but as a cartoonist, as an animator, especially since he is such a fan of the classic Looney Tunes shorts. Dante has said, though, his real film education didn't come from the Philadelphia College of Art, but with Roger Corman, at New World Pictures, actually. That relationship went so well that Dante was finally given his shot in the director's chair with 1976's Hollywood Nights, along with co-director Alan Arkush, the future director of 1981's Heartbeeps. I found an article from Sci-Fi that was published back in January of 2018, where Dante shares the important advice that Roger Corman gave him about stepping up to the director's chair. He said, quote, "Roger Corman gave me a piece of advice that he gave to everybody who works for him. He'd always take you out before you started shooting, and he would give you a little tutorial about what to do and how to do it. His first piece of advice, most important, was sit down a lot, because it's a difficult job. So I took that advice, but I realized the movie was so cheap that I was making, there were no chairs." End quote. I'll be sure to include the link to that interview on the podcast post for this episode on The Retroist.
You do realize, however, that Joe Dante, even for all of his talents, did not singularly bring the Shadow Man to television himself, yes?
Of course I do, my friend. Dante was working from the screenplay by the very capable Rockne S. O'Bannon. You might know O'Bannon from his work on the 1986 episode of Amazing Stories, entitled Life on Death Row, featuring the late and great Patrick Swayze as a death row inmate who is given healing powers. Actually, the story itself was courtesy of none other than Mick Garris. O'Bannon wrote the script for 1988's Alien Nation, created Sequest 2032, and even Farscape, to name a few of his accomplishments.
Before we viewed this episode for the Vault staff, you stood up and shared your memories of seeing this very episode for the first time. I am positive that the dear listeners will find it just as amusing, Victor.
It's a story I've told a few times, Projectionist. As I've already said, I was excited about the new Twilight Zone, and while I didn't always get to control the TV viewing with my family, in this case, it probably helped that on Friday nights, the Twilight Zone would lead into what my father and grandparents always watched on CBS, which was Dallas, followed by Falcon Crest. Anyway, for some reason, on the night the November 29th, 1985 episode of the new Twilight Zone aired, my father and myself were at our local Walmart. Normally, I would be heading straight to the toy aisle. But I knew what time it was, so I went straight to the electronics section. Now, please understand that back in the day, there were two rows, with about 30 or 35 television sets of varying sizes on display. They were on both sides of the aisles, so it was like you were walking through a tunnel of televisions. It appears that whoever was in charge of this portion of the electronics section was a Twilight Zone fan themselves, as every single channel was tuned to CBS. 30-plus TVs broadcasting that familiar intro for the 85 Twilight Zone, played by Jerry Garcia of the Grateful Dead. I was immediately sucked in. So, I stood in front of the biggest TV there and watched the entire episode. And with that surround sound effect, plus the creepiness of the Shadow Man itself, it burned the memory of the segment into my brain. After the shocking ending, I went in search for the comfort of the toy aisles. All right, Projectionist, I think it's time we dive into the synopsis for the Shadow Man, don't you?
Did you hear that, Sage?
No. Is it that ghoul fever-infected rat? I thought you and Rockford J strengthened the vents in the Retroist vault.
No, no. Calm yourself, silly boy. No, I heard something when you mentioned you were about to discuss the synopsis for the Shadow Man. It sounded to me like thousands of our dear listeners turning off their radios.
Very funny, Projectionist. Friends, obviously if you haven't had the opportunity to see the Shadow Man for yourself, we will be going into full spoilers. So if you want to watch it first, please hit pause. I'm pretty sure you can find it on a couple of spots on the internet. With the spoiler warning out of the way, let's begin. As the Shadow Man begins, we are introduced to Danny Hayes, played by Jonathan Ward of The New Adventures of Bean Baxter, and his best friend, Peter, in the school library in the town of Willow Creek. While Peter is focusing on doing his homework, Danny is coming up with ideas on how he might impress Liana Ames, the young girl he has a massive crush on. Everything from obtaining concert tickets, sending her one anonymously so that she would be sitting next to him if she attended, to just gifting her flowers. This has the effect of annoying Peter, who is naturally trying to finish his homework, as well as avoiding the disapproving stares of the librarian, as Danny forgets to use his inside voice. Danny can't be dissuaded from coming up with the perfect plan to woo Liana. After all, as we learn, he's not only finished with his homework, he's actually just passing the time on extra credit questions. This surprises Peter, as apparently Danny already has the best grade point average in the entire school. If he aces those extra credit questions, it will alter the grading curve, and as Peter is quick to point out, it will mean everyone else will get worse grades. To which Danny replies coldly, "Yeah, so?" While I didn't notice that in my first viewing, you know, standing in Walmart, when this episode was included in the Season 1 DVD collection back in 2004, I was surprised by two things. How well O'Bannon and Dante clued us in almost immediately that Danny has some issues. In this case, a real lack of empathy. And really how great an acting job that Jonathan Ward does for this segment. With his cold reply, which, by the way, would mean Peter's grades would be hurt too, Dante pushes in on a close-up of Danny, and Ward has such a lack of emotion in his eyes, it's kind of chilling. As we see in the next scene, as Danny is walking home at night, he has a bigger problem than getting the attention of Liana. The problem is something I was all too familiar with as a kid. School bullies. In this case, a trio led by a boy named Eric, played by Explorers Jason Presson. In fact, the reason he got the part was thanks to his appearing in Dante's film. Well, not only does Eric thrill to see Danny squirm, but it turns out that he is dating Liana. Eric sets up a trap for Danny. He obviously knows that he likes Liana, and to be fair, the young girl really doesn't want to be part of the prank, but she finally caves in due to Eric's pleading.
"I presume that Eric and his cronies are more popular in school, thanks to their inclusion on the swim team."
I'm sure you're right, projectionist. Danny is surprised to see Liana step out from behind a hedge. Thinking fortune must have smiled on him, he is only focusing on her. Which is why he is so shocked when two of Eric's friends, dressed in butcher's aprons with one kid wearing a pig's mask and the other a witch's mask, jump out with chainsaws and start chasing Danny. The young man doesn't get far before Eric himself leaps out and laughs as Danny falls to the ground. It's as if everything becomes clear for the frightened kid, and we realize that those chainsaws are quite fake. In fact, the two boys are making chainsaw noises as they're chasing Danny. Eric assures Danny that his reputation as the biggest chicken in Willow Creek is still upheld after running away. Although, I'd like to personally see how Eric would have reacted if the situation was reversed.
"Oh, but we do see that very thing later in the episode, Sage."
You're right, projectionist. We later see Danny at home. It's hard not to notice that he has on lots of lights in his room, as well as the TV and even the radio. Something that very quickly his mother chides him about. And we realize that Danny, who is 13 years old, is still quite uncomfortable in the dark. His mother, having lost her patience, turns out all the lights in the room, even the TV and radio, before wishing her son a good night.
"What occurs next is the exact opposite of the definition of a good night."
Absolutely. The bed starts to shake like there is a minor earthquake, and as it settles, Danny gets an even bigger shock than from the bullies earlier, as the Shadow Man rises up from underneath his bed and introduces himself.
"I am the Shadow Man, and I will never harm the person under whose bed I live."
With that, the Shadow Man glides over to Danny Hayes' bedroom window, which swings open on its own, before the entity presumably glides out into the darkness of the night.
The Shadow Man, as Dante explained it in an interview I read online, not only mentioned that the character was a visual nod to the pulp icon of the Shadow, which, sorry for the plug, I totally covered in the last Pop Culture Retrorama podcast episode, but considering the character is in fact a shadowy form, it was extremely tough to film. The actor who played the Shadow Man, by the way, was Jeff Calhoun. The next day, Danny attempts to tell Peter what occurred, but his friend is dubious at best, blaming it all on something his friend ate. Danny adds that he spent the remainder of the night downstairs on the couch, but just before dawn, he heard the shadow man return and go back under his bed. As the two boys enter the school, one of their schoolmates is talking about an incident that occurred the previous night. It seems that after the shadow man made his appearance to Danny, two teenagers from the school were attacked at the nearby MacGyver Park. The young man had his arm broken as he attempted to protect his date and is now in the hospital. Definitely seems like the shadow man isn't something to take lightly. Later that night, Danny has a plan to make sure Peter, and I assume his parents, believe him about the shadow man living under his bed. He attempts to stay up with a Polaroid camera. However, thanks to the lack of sleep the previous night, he dozes off, waking up as his new supernatural roommate appears from beneath the bed again. Wouldn't you know it, the camera works, but the flash bulbs don't go off.
It is never explained, dear listeners, but I felt while watching this episode that it was the Shadow Man's doing. A protection, if you will, to ward off anyone taking its photograph clearly.
That might be the case, Projectionist. A few days have passed when we next see Danny and Peter at the local cafe. Almost looks like a malt shop. It's definitely where the kids come after school, though. And as you might imagine, all the talk is on the mysterious stranger that comes out at night. The town sounds like it's beginning to impose a curfew. The movie theater will be closing early, etc. Peter still doesn't believe Danny. And this response definitely upsets his friend, who asks him to come over and see for himself. Peter, though, admits he wouldn't be caught dead going out after dark.
I wonder, what would the Shadow Man do if he found someone other than Danny in the room as he emerged from under the bed?
Probably attack them, my friend. When Peter takes off, Danny overhears Liana and Eric talking. It turns out the young girl is having some issues with algebra and wants her boyfriend to come over and help her with her homework. We should have pointed this out earlier, but Liana is played by Heather House, who you might recognize from 1984's TV movie, Sweet Revenge, where she plays the young version of Kelly McGillis. Eric initially begs off, saying he has swim practice, but he too admits he doesn't want to go out after dark. Boom! Just like that, Danny has the perfect way to impress Liana, which is why he surprises her by showing up at her door that night. I mean, after all, the Shadow Man has promised he won't harm him. This sets off a surprising chain reaction. When we next see Danny at school, he's with a young girl, and it appears he's now part of the popular crowd. Much to the irritation of Eric, of course. A day or so later, Peter, who now isn't part of Danny's social circle, delivers some unsettling news. One of their schoolmates who lives next to Peter was attacked the previous night. Apparently, the kid was only outside for a couple of seconds. Peter thinks Danny should tell someone about what he knows. Although Danny, in what seems to be a mocking tone, reminds his former friend that no one would believe such a thing. Eric has had quite enough, and challenges Danny to a fight. His father told him to lay off Hayes until after the season was over so he wouldn't risk being bounced off the swim team. I guess seeing Danny with Liana and hanging out with the cool kids is just too much. Danny, shockingly, agrees, but he chooses the location to not be at the diner, but at MacGyver Park at 9 p.m.
It looks as if Danny Hayes is putting a plan into effect to remove Eric from his life permanently.
Well, maybe not permanently, as we don't thankfully hear of any of the kids being killed. I'm not sure why the Shadow Man is attacking them. Maybe he feeds off their fear. Come 9 p.m., Danny is waiting for Eric at the park, and he couldn't be more calm. Of course, while this is the place that most of the attacks have gone down, he knows he doesn't have to worry about the Shadow Man. Eric is ready to give Danny the beating of his life, but the teenager just sits calmly on a swing, with a smug smile on his face as the bully approaches him. Eric stops in his tracks as we see, from behind Danny, the Shadow Man rise up to full height behind him. Eric, to his credit, yells for Danny to run for his life as he takes off down the street. In fact, you can hear him calling for Danny to join him as he books it back home. I should point out the obvious. Danny was hoping that the Shadow Man would hurt Eric. Don't get me wrong, the kid is a jerk and a bully. But so is Danny. Like I've already mentioned, he shows a distinct lack of empathy beyond anyone other than himself, which is why he's so confused as to why his supernatural roommate isn't giving chase after Eric.
He's even more bewildered when the Shadow Man lashes out and grips him by the throat, raising him up in the air.
Hey! It's me! Don't you recognize me? Hey, you said you'd never hurt me!
I
promise!
The Shadow Man. And I will never harm the person under whose bed I live.
Well?
But I am a Shadow Man from under someone else's bed.
As the segment entitled The Shadow Man ends, we see Danny kicking his feet in the air as this other Shadow Man holds him aloft, chuckling. What happens to Danny Hayes? Well, if you go by what Joe Dante said in an interview from ComingSoon.net back in 2015, he says that in his mind, Jonathan Ward's character is killed after the screen fades to black. I have sadly not been able to find O'Bannon's original screenplay for The Shadow Man, so I'm not sure if it revealed the true fate of Danny Hayes or not. But I think when the director of the segment says the young boy doesn't walk away, it's hard to ignore that. Of course, having said that, I'm that lone fan who actually prefers the theatrical version of Ridley Scott's Blade Runner from 1982. So perhaps the correct answer is to say the ending is left up to the viewers themselves. Here's a fun fact. Heather House actually appeared in another new Twilight Zone segment. That was for 1987's Time and Teresa Galowitz, and would appear in two more Joe Dante-related films, 1989's underappreciated comedy, The Burbs, as well as a cameo in 1990's Gremlins 2, The New Batch, where she was cast as one of the employees at the yogurt stand. Which is appropriate, as Jason Presson was also cast by Dante as the other yogurt stand employee. In that sequel to Gremlins, you had a nice little reunion of Eric and Liana. Well, before the Gremlins took over Clamp Towers, that is. While House has continued in the movie business as a location manager, securing filming spots for such films and TV shows like 2007's Transformers live-action movie, Glee, and American Horror Story to name a few, Presson, it seems, retired from acting in 1997, with his last acting role being in the TV movie Trials of Life. But, besides Explorers, he was also seen in 1988's Lady in White, as well as Saturday the 14th Strikes Back. Jonathan Ward would retire from acting in 1998, but he made appearances in quite a few popular TV shows and films too, such as Charles in Charge, Whitewater Summer with Kevin Bacon, Mac and Me, and he lent his voice to the character of Zack in 1992's Fern Gully, The Last Rainforest. The Shadow Man himself, Jeff Calhoun, became a well-known choreographer, and he even directed Disney's Newsies, the Broadway musical, in 2017. In closing, with 1985's The Shadow Man, I definitely think it holds up. And much like I went on and on at the beginning of this show about how the original series had a sense of cosmic justice, I feel The Shadow Man followed that. Say, unlike with the subject of our next show, Grandma. Projectionist, do you have anything to add?
Only that this episode manages to balance levity with horror. There are quite a few humorous moments that occur, mostly involving Danny Hayes' interaction with the Shadow Man. I would, in addition, go on record as saying that the young punk got what he deserved at the hands of the Shadow Man.
We've got to warn people.
What do you see?
The howling. Somewhere in this city, in this human jungle, it begins.
What do you see?
What's there?
What do you see, Karen?
What's there?
Somewhere in these woods, in this primal, sensuous, secret place lies an experience too terrifying for words. And now, all anyone can do is watch and wait.
Knight, I'm going to show you something. Make you believe.
Friends, I think that about brings us to the end of our episode.
Cease that blasted noise, Victor!
Vic, projectionist?
Hey, Rockford J. We were about to wrap up the podcast on Twilight Zone's The Shadow Man. What's up?
That is perfect timing because I just got out of Auditorium Number 4, where we screened the January 31st, 1986 episode of The Twilight Zone. That's the episode with To See the Invisible Man, Tooth and Consequences, and The Elevator.
Ooh, The Elevator is a great one. Talk about super creepy. That segment was actually written by Ray Bradbury, I believe.
It was, Vic.
Intern Rockford J., how is it that you had time to attend this screening? Surely you have not completed inventorying my collection of motion picture magazine.
All taken care of, sir.
You used the archivist gloves on the 1911 issues?
Absolutely, projectionist.
Rockford, my friend, I'm positive that if you just talked with a retroist, there's no way with as much work as you do, and as long as you've been with the Vault, that you are still an intern.
Silence, Sage! Now then, intern Rockford J., you were talking about the Twilight Zone episode, The Elevator, yes?
Oh yeah, The Elevator. Well, The Elevator was the first segment of that Twilight Zone episode, projectionist. When I was a kid growing up in the 70s and 80s, there was not an overwhelming amount of genre material on network television. Unlike today, when we're blessed to live in an environment where there's maybe too much content, both quantity-wise and quality-wise, to even keep up with, where streaming services are producing new original material at a pace that it's hard for me and probably other people to keep up with. Back in those days, if there was a genre show on a network, I was going to watch it because there was not a whole lot of it to see. And certainly when I became aware that The Twilight Zone was being revived by CBS, I was on board from the very beginning. I had become acquainted with the original Twilight Zone through syndicated reruns and was pretty familiar, if not with all of the episodes, with certainly the style and the feel of the show. And I knew that I was going to get in on the ground floor of Twilight Zone 2.0, if you will. This particular segment, though, The Elevator, I don't know that I had seen in a long time and only recently was able to sort of refresh my recollection of. And it's a fun segment. It reminds me actually quite a bit of The Night Gallery, which was, of course, Rod Serling's show after the original Twilight Zone. The original Twilight Zone, of course, for four of its five seasons was a half-hour format with each episode having one self-contained story with a beginning, middle, and an end. The new Twilight Zone shared, in common with Night Gallery, a format with stories in each episode of different lengths, so that you could have one long episode, you could have two episodes of equal length, or you could have sort of a mid-sized episode with a couple of shorter segments. And The Elevator is about 10 minutes. It is very concise, it gets on, it does the job, and it gets off. And it's a wonderful illustration of what anthology TV shows were like in the 70s and the 80s, in that unlike a regular series, which would amortize the production cost of a series over a 22 or 24 episode season by spending money on standing sets and reoccurring actors where you spread the cost out over the entire run, anthology shows had to be done sort of on the cheap because you couldn't amortize those costs out over a season. So typically you would have two or three speaking parts, one or two locations, one or two recognizable name actors, and then some folks you might not know quite as well. And The Elevator is a perfect illustration of that. You've got basically two speaking parts, one of them an actor who at the time was becoming pretty well known for some film work, and that being Stephen Jeffries, an actor named Robert Prescott, who I'm not as familiar with, and then basically two locations, an interior and an exterior. And the exterior, to me, looks like something that could have been shot on the same studio lot where the soundstage was, where they filmed the interior. But it's not a long segment, don't get much background, just enough to know what's going on with the characters. These are two brothers, an older brother and a younger brother, who are looking for their father, who we learn from the dialogue is a scientist who is working on developing new food sources to feed the ever-increasing population of the world. And it's a wonderful segment. It's very moody. There's some great lighting, there's some great props, and a lot of great energy from Stephen Jeffries, who portrays a character not too dissimilar, at least in his demeanor, from Evil Ed from the original Fright Night. It gets on, it does the job, and it gives you a fun little zing at the end. Twilight Zones, of course, are well known for their twists, and this is not too dissimilar from that. This episode, of course, was written by Ray Bradbury. I don't know. He gets the writing credit, so I assume he wrote the screenplay too. I don't know if maybe it was based on an original short story that he had written previously, or if he wrote this originally new for this new Twilight Zone. But it's fun. It gets on. It does the job. It gives you a little goose at the end, and then you're on to the next segment. I miss this kind of anthology series. I will say, of course, you know, there's a new Twilight Zone on CBS streaming that I've seen a couple of episodes of. They didn't really do very much for me. One of them I thought was overly long, and one of them had a little goose at the end that I didn't think fit terribly well in with the previous parts of the episode. And so I think that new series could certainly take some lessons from a segment like The Elevator. If you haven't seen it, check it out. It's fun to watch.
Thanks for sharing that, Rockford. Seriously, you do need to talk with the retro...
Yes, thank you, intern Rockford J. I look forward to seeing you bright and early tomorrow morning. We need to file down the growths upon the runestones.
Runestones? What are you doing messing with runestones, projectionist?
I'll be there, sir. I just hope nothing comes through the portals again. That last entity scratched up my overalls. They were my new pair, too.
That will be quite enough of that, I believe.
With how you treat Rockford, you better hope that he doesn't know the Shadow Man or something.
And who's to say he doesn't?
And with that unsettling thought, thank you, listeners, for taking the time to check out the Saturday Frights podcast. The music you heard at the beginning and ending of our podcast was provided by Peachy. If you have musical needs, you can contact him at peachy@retroist.com. My co-host, The Projectionist, has his own Facebook page, Projectionist Haunted Drive-In. It's always neat to see what vintage thing he can dig up to share. A huge thank you to Rockford J for sharing his own memories on the 1985 Twilight Zone. You can find him every day sharing his own love of retro horror on the Saturday Frights Facebook page. As for myself, you can still find me posting a couple times a day on not just the Saturday Frights page, but the Diary of an Arcade Employee page too, as well as the Retroist site. I even managed to find time to share some things on the Retroist Clubhouse now and again. If you'd like to contact me with suggestions for future episodes, you can reach me at vicsage@retroist.com. Of course, we owe a great deal of gratitude to the Retroist himself, not just for hosting the podcast, but for creating a place where we can all share in our love of all things retro. So when you need your retro fix, and we all do, make sure to visit The Retroist. If you like the show, please consider subscribing and giving us a rating over on iTunes and Stitcher or Spotify to help spread the word. Now let's listen to a clip from the subject of our next show.
George! Bring me my tea!
This has been a Retroist production. Sleep well and goodbye.